Helen, Bob, choir, and ladies and gentlemen, I would like to make a confession. If I were any happier than I am at this moment to be in this room with all of you, I am positive it would be sinful. Some of you who are in this audience this morning can share that happiness. If you like, please notice a note in the bulletin that we have a new member class that we will be inducted soon. Take a look at the date for the inquirers classes and come and be a part of this amazing happiness. The sermon this morning will be relevant for some of us right now, and for more of us, few more of us, I suppose, a few years from now. So even if you are in the second group, I hope you'll listen. How many of you can remember when you first noticed that you were looking backward too often and forward too little? When the past began to preoccupy your thoughts more often than the future? When you had more fun remembering than anticipating? I'm not talking about a legitimate look once in a while at milestones. We all like to recall those at times. Here's a picture of our first car. That was Jimmy's graduation day. Here's a shot of the old building where we started the family business. Not that popular game, but the point at which some of us settle down into a kind of permanent fascination with memories rather than with prospects. And age may or may not be a factor, because I think the Apostle Paul caught a young friend of his doing that centuries ago when he said to Titus, "I want you to avoid genealogies." Now, Paul probably wasn't talking about what we call family trees, but I do think he felt Titus might be too much interested in things that belong to a dead past and not enough in things that belonged to the living present. Some of our members in this church are genuine Yankees who know that the old charge against New England was that the favorite question tended to be, "Who was your grandfather?" Out here and farther west, where the issues of making a life and having the skills to survive were so crucial, the question was more likely to be, "What can you do?" If you could do the job, no one worried much about your pedigree. I would tend to cast my vote with that party. I find myself annoyed with one of Job's comforters, one of those three, you remember, who came to see him during his great illness and only made him worse with their reliance on history. One of them, named Bildad, was a traditionalist with so little confidence in the vital present that he kept his head stuck deep in the comfortable past. "What you need to do," he told Job, "is to inquire of bygone ages and consider what the fathers have found." Well, I'd be the last person to deny the good uses of history, but one of the first to admit that we are always tempted to romanticize it. So I'm interpreting Paul's comment about avoiding genealogies as an order, very much like the one some of us used to get from the drill sergeant when he barked, "Eyes front." We knew what he meant. No looking around at our neighbors, no turning around to talk to the guy in back. Straight ahead. And that, I take it, is what Paul is saying to Titus about how to keep his life in order. You could call it, I suppose, a plea for the prophetic view of life, which lives primarily on hope, instead of the nostalgic view of life, which polishes and arranges antiques and lives on memory. H.G. Wells recorded a conversation once of two men standing in the Colosseum at Rome. One of them said, awestruck, "Think of the famous people who have stood here." I like that. Respect for the past is a mark of good sense. But the other man said something that excites me more. He heard those rather conventional words, "Think of those who stood here," and he said, out of his different orientation, "Think of the people who will." And I like to define Christianity by that comment as a religion of anticipation and hope, a religion with a forward look. The scribes and the Pharisees, as you know, missed this. They were puzzled, or at least they pretended to be, when the people who walked with Jesus ignored some of the old traditional customs. He, in turn, told the scribes and Pharisees that they had gotten themselves frozen in the past. "Isaiah had you in mind, gentlemen," he said to them, "when he prophesied, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me.'" Scribes and Pharisees, some of them, never all, scrupulously religious people who noticed that the followers of Jesus did not wash their hands ritually before meals, as people had always done in the past, but who failed utterly to see that Christ was something that would revolutionize the future. They were not interested in the fresh, clear water he was bringing to desperately thirsty people. They were obsessed with pots and pans and the trivia that they thought set them apart from others and somehow justified them with God. One thinks of all the churches torn apart between that distant time and this, simply because people valued their line of descent more than the claims of the present. Some of the battles over trifles in church life have made about as much sense as the war described by Swift in Gulliver's Travels between the group that thought an egg should be cracked at the big end and the group that thought it should be cracked only at the little end. So the big enders and the little enders fought to the death and ruined their country in a contest over nothing. As I see it, there are two questions that grow out of Paul's advice to avoid genealogies. They both have to do with discovering the truth about an institution. Say one like the church, since that's where we are this morning. One of the questions faces backwards. What is its pedigree? Has it been here a long time, and does it have a good reputation? The other question insists on honesty about the present, and it can make us squirm. Is this institution still useful? Does it do any good? Has it lost itself so deeply in pride for its past, for its manners and customs, that nothing ever happens in its present? We may prefer the first question because it is so much safer to talk about where we came from than it is to talk about where we are or where we're headed. The past, after all, is finished. You can rummage around in it without much danger. I read a note the other day about an English banker who had been persuaded by a white hunter friend of his in Uganda to go out looking for lions, something the banker was more than a little reluctant to do. The first night out, in fact, he was so full of imagined fears that he couldn't sleep. And the next morning, up bright and early, the hunter located some fresh tracks close to their tent. He happily showed his friend how they could be identified as the tracks of a full-grown male lion, and it was clear that he was eager to get started. The nervous banker was less eager, and he came up with a brilliant idea. He said, "Let me suggest something. You go ahead and see where he went. I'll go back and see where he came from." Much less dangerous to trace that lion's recent history than to enter the future with him. We are a society given to slogans on signboards and bumpers everywhere you look. But slogans are risky things for an institution for two reasons. One is that they're always only partly true and often misleading. And the other is that they become part of the genealogy, the family tree, the tradition, to which, if we are not careful, we pay too much attention. I had a man tell me with great pride once how his pet poodle would not eat except from its accustomed plate. Put the food in another container, he showed me, and the dog would walk away. I don't know whether the dog would have refused to eat until he starved, but I have met people who will eat no intellectual food unless it comes marked with a familiar label and delivered in a traditional can. I've often thought it would be good if all party catchwords, denominational slogans, had a warning on them, good for only 6 months. Why? Because they petrify otherwise under the pressures of a changing world, and they turn into fossils which people have to carry like a burden when they ought to be free to concentrate on the present. Christianity is meant to be an eyes front religion, always trying to find some new way to make old ideas look as if they had just been born. Paul, who said, "Avoid genealogies, give up the pedigree chase," would have liked a comment I read last week. A man who has nothing to boast of except his ancestry is like a potato plant. The best part of him is underground. So how does it all apply to our place, to this church? Well, in the first place, it leaves me free to pay a compliment. Maybe it's because we're still quite young, but we do not seem to be obsessed with the past. We do not dwell on 5 years ago. We do not talk endlessly of pilgrims and Puritans and the Mayflower. We don't even have a little denominational slogan, unless you count that note at the bottom of our stationery, which says that we are a place where head and heart are equal partners in faith. And while that tries to say something very important about our religion, even that we don't repeat until it loses meaning. I got myself into hot water once some years ago for suggesting that a slogan used by several hundred congregational churches around the country is a kind of genealogical freak, that it means so much that it really doesn't mean anything. You may remember it, some of you. the claim that the distinctive hallmarks of a congregational church are faith, freedom, and fellowship. I would shy away from that in the first place because it's too cute, too pat, too catchy. What with that sacred number three and the alliteration to help us memorize it, and a trio of words with such inoffensive connotations that it would be hard to imagine how anyone could quarrel with them. But if you hear a slogan like that, and you never ask whether it really means anything, then you've slipped into the trap Paul told Titus to avoid. I would never want you to hear those words spoken glibly from a pulpit without asking yourselves, now what do those words mean? And how accurately do they describe my church as I know it? And when you do that, of course, you get into trouble. No problem at all with one of the words, freedom. To the extent that there is no gag rule on this pulpit, and to the extent that this is a church free of any control except its own, it seems true to me that we demonstrate a rather impressive kind of freedom among Protestant churches. In fact, this is the very thing I always stress when I want to present my faith attractively to others. But I would have to confess that I don't find any real distinctiveness in the other two parts of the slogan. Do faith and fellowship exist in some special measure in congregational churches so that we could point to those qualities as unique among us? Faith is a precious commodity we share with other Christians, but I couldn't honestly claim that we have so much of it that it becomes a veritable hallmark of a congregational church. For one thing, we probably emphasize reason too much for that to be true. And fellowship? Well, we have great camaraderie, it seems to me, but it probably isn't closer or better than can be found in some other churches. Are we disloyal to ourselves somehow to say such things? I don't think so. We simply want words to mean something. We want to be honest. I happen to think men and women are eager for that kind of honesty, and that if we practice it, we will draw some excellent people into our family. Our past, as a church, a congregational faith dating back some 400 years, was truly glorious at times, but like any other church I know, it was also embarrassing at times. We're not honest if we talk only about how important freedom was to the pilgrims without admitting that there were sorry times when they denied that same freedom to others. But if we avoid genealogies, we won't spend a whole lot of time on either the dark or the sunny side of our history. We were invited not into a museum, but to a pilgrimage. He did not say, come sit with me and admire what we have done together. He said, follow me into the future. And a church which is alive will always be trying to figure out how to do that in a way that makes good sense in the living present. I think we try to do that, and I'm glad, and I hope it will characterize this church for a long, long time. Please come back next Sunday when we will talk about the most difficult and honest question any person can ask of himself or herself.